You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The Ideas Network is bringing you a documentary series about a little-known process with massive consequences. It's called WPR Reports Mapped Out, and it is a deep dive into redistricting and what it has meant for Wisconsin. In today's bonus episode, WPR's Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson, they take us through what happened in the first part of this year's redistricting cycle and what it could mean for the state going forward.
There are times in modern politics when, and this is an understatement, it really sounds like Democrats and Republicans are talking about completely different things.
Like, they could be debating a bill, and it sounds like they're not even talking to each other. It's as if they're on totally different planets.
Take the public hearing on the legislature's proposed redistricting plan this year. Remember, these are the maps that will shape Wisconsin's political boundaries for the next decade.
Good morning to all the members and to the chairman.
Robin Voss, the powerful Republican Assembly Speaker, is testifying in favor of maps his party has drawn. The maps at this point are bills, and he's the lead author.
To be clear, it is the duty of the state legislature, as laid out in our state constitution, to, quote, apportion and district anew the members of the Senate and Assembly.
Voss is bragging about the new maps. He says they meet all the legal requirements of redistricting and should be passed.
But when Democrats get a chance to ask questions of Voss, a pattern emerges. They want to talk about the old maps, the ones Republicans passed in 2011.
And if you've listened to this podcast, some of it might sound familiar. Jeff Smith, a Democratic senator, alludes to the non-disclosure agreements Republicans had to sign to look at their districts that year.
Since you signed our non-disclosure agreements in 2011, is that done, or can you talk about 2011 now, or?
You know, it's interesting that you would choose that vein of questioning, because what we have before us, I was not speaker. I was not in charge of redistricting.
You were in the legislature, and you signed one of those non-disclosures.
Yeah, I was in the legislature.
And Kelder Royes, a Democratic senator from Madison, wants to talk about the last maps, too.
We can agree that that happened. It was widely reported at the time. I just want to make sure that the record is clear that that did happen and that members in this room did sign those secrecy oaths. Now,
well, first of all, let me just correct that, okay? You are using terms meant to incite an opinion, right? A secrecy oath, right?
More than an hour into the hearing, it's clear that Voss has had it. He doesn't want to talk about the old maps anymore.
It is because you want to talk about the past, I want to talk about the future.
On the surface, this sounds like one of those political moments where both sides are talking past each other.
But this time, they're actually talking about the same thing. Because the new maps, the ones Voss is proposing, are based on the old maps.
We know that the map drawn in 2011 was a good one for Republicans. So this is going to be a critical question over the next few months. Can this map that helped cement GOP power for the past decade be reused for the next 10 years?
From WPR Reports, I'm Sean Johnson.
And I'm Bridget Bowden. This is Mapped Out.
The story of redistricting in Wisconsin is full of intrigue and drama. It's a political thriller with twists and turns along the way.
But there are some things that we always knew were going to happen this year. We knew Republican lawmakers would pass maps, and they did.
There are 60 ayes, 38 nays. Senate Bill 621 is concurred in, gentlemen from the...
We knew Democratic Governor Tony Evers would veto those maps. And he did.
These gerrymandered maps will not become law.
So that's where we are. But it's not about the destination, it's the journey.
So even though this part of the story was the most predictable, it's noteworthy. And it's important because it's setting up the legal fight that will actually decide what Wisconsin's new political maps will look like.
Let's start from the beginning. As you know, redistricting starts with the census. This year, the results were delayed because of the pandemic.
So redistricting didn't really get started until August. That's when the first lawsuits were filed.
And in September, the legislature took its first votes on redistricting. Sort of. GOP lawmakers introduced a joint resolution that spelled out their priorities for drawing maps.
A joint resolution. This is not a bill. It's non-binding. It's the legislature saying, here's what we think.
There wasn't much debate on this resolution when it came up for a vote, and the only Republican to speak was Assembly Speaker Voss, who said it was the legislature's duty to handle redistricting, not the governor or the courts.
So hopefully, you won't just continue to take the no way, no how, never route, which is kind of where you've been before, and accept the fact that this resolution lays out the principles that we are going to utilize to ensure that we have a map that will last during the next 10 years, just like the last one has during the past decade.
But it's just a resolution. It doesn't actually require anything. It doesn't go to the governor's desk. It's not law.
At the end of the day, it's the legislature saying, we, the legislative branch, get to do redistricting. And here are the principles we value, because we said so. We're the legislature.
Among those principles, one person, one vote. Comply with the Voting Rights Act. These are required by the U.S. Constitution and federal law.
Also on the list, draw districts that are compact and contiguous and avoid splitting up local boundaries. These are required under the Wisconsin Constitution.
But this Republican resolution also included redistricting criteria that are not required, like avoiding putting two incumbents in the same district.
And this one is key, retaining as much as possible of the core of existing districts.
In other words, keep as much as possible of the map Republicans drew a decade ago. So, as you might imagine, Democrats like Mark Spreitzer were not happy.
This latest resolution is just more of the same, trying to cling to power and saying anything you can in order to come up with a justification for doing that.
This resolution passed, and when the Republican maps came out in October, they were pretty true to the principles it laid out.
And because of that, the 2021 map looked a lot like the 2011 map. When you retain as much as possible of existing districts, like the resolution said, you end up not making a lot of changes.
In the world of redistricting shorthand, this is often referred to as core retention. But University of Wisconsin-Madison law professor Rob Yablon has a different name for it, gerrylaundering.
Gerrylaundering is an attempt to perpetuate an existing biased map by carrying forward the existing lines with as little change as you can get away with.
The idea of core retention, where you preserve an existing map, is definitely not new in redistricting, but by no means is it a widely accepted norm.
Yablon found that of all 50 states, only three have laws or constitutional provisions that endorse core retention. Wisconsin is not among them. And in 2011, core retention was not a priority for Republican map drawers.
Yablon says another red flag is the way Republicans want to avoid incumbent pairing.
But what does that mean? Okay, think of it this way. The legislature's full of Republicans. Pairing them means changing the lines so that more than one incumbent ends up living in the same district. That means they'd have to run against one another, and only one of them could stay.
When a map avoids incumbent pairing, it avoids those fights. The incumbents get to stay. In other words, it means fewer of them are at risk of losing their jobs. On the whole, more GOP lawmakers are protected.
Again, this is not unheard of in the world of redistricting, but it's not a hard and fast rule. Republicans didn't follow it 10 years ago. In Wisconsin, it's not required by state law or the Constitution. And Yablon's research found several states actually ban mapmakers from favoring incumbents.
Which is why Yablon, who testified against Wisconsin's Republican-drawn maps, says Republicans are gerrylaundering.
It's clear that the goal for the Republicans and the legislature is to carry forward as much of the existing gerrymander as they can.
Now, you won't hear Republicans use words like gerrymander or gerrylaunder to describe their map, but they've definitely talked about carrying forward the existing map, which they say is a good one.
But as you might remember, Democrats, including Governor Tony Evers, have decidedly different views on those 2011 Republican maps. And Evers promised an alternative this year, drawn by his People's Maps Commission.
And the People's Maps proposal, while it was hotly debated on the floor, didn't go anywhere. Even some Democrats voted against it.
So what did pass? The Republican plan.
What that meant, after the break.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to WPR Reports Mapped Out with Bridget Bowden and Sean Johnson.
So Democrats call the GOP redistricting plan gerrylandering. Republicans have another way to describe it.
They call it a least changes map. In other words, adjusting the 2011 map for population changes and not much else.
There are practical reasons Republicans would want to do this. Obviously, the last map was really good for them. They like it. And it mostly survived multiple lawsuits. So if you think the new map is going to court, the old map? Not a bad place to start.
But if you take a close look at the map, the new Republican map, there are some places where the changes are significant. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University. He studies redistricting trends and data.
It's very clear that they don't change the districts that they like, and they do change the districts where they think that they can either pick off a Democrat or shore up a Republican who needs help.
In other words, this map that Republicans call least changes does make strategic changes that benefit their party.
A good example of this is in Milwaukee's suburbs, where there are communities that have been changing over the past decade. The only seats Democrats flipped under the old map are in these suburbs. It's really the only part of the map where Republicans are threatened.
If you look at those districts, the competitive suburban districts, you get a pretty good snapshot of the decisions Republicans made in their new map.
We'll get really specific with one example here to give you a better idea. In Wisconsin, three assembly districts are nested inside every Senate district. So let's focus on one state Senate district and its three assembly districts.
So the Senate district first. It's held by Republican Dale Coinga of Brookfield. He won his last election by just 2.5 percentage points. And according to Johnson's research, the district actually has a slight Democratic lean.
So what do the assembly districts look like? Well, they include two of the only seats Democrats were ever able to flip in the last decade, currently held by Sarah Rodriguez of Brookfield and Robin Vining of Wauwatosa. And the third assembly district is held by Republican Joe Sanfilippo of New Berlin.
In the new map, Republicans make trade-offs. Vining's assembly district gets a lot more Democratic. It all but guarantees Republicans will never win there.
But at the same time, the other two assembly districts get a lot more Republican. Rodriguez's district goes from super competitive to safe Republican. And Sanfilippo's seat gets extremely red.
In essence, Republicans made a two-for-one deal with these assembly seats. But the real prize for them is in the Senate, where Dale Coinga's seat would also get safer.
Which is why Marquette's John Johnson says it's wrong to call the latest Republican map least changes.
I mean, who cares about a least changes map? Like, no one actually believes that that matters. I've never met anyone who sincerely believes that that's, like, a legitimate goal for a map. no one cares about that. So I struggle to even respond to that because I think it's such a disingenuous point.
When you look at all the changes on this map, based on Johnson's analysis, Republicans would be expected to win 63 seats in the assembly, up from the 61 they have now. And in the Senate, Republicans would be expected to win 23 seats, up from 21.
That would leave Republicans just a few seats away from winning a supermajority. So if Republicans had a good year, they could win enough seats in the legislature to override a governor's veto. GOP lawmakers could run things in Wisconsin, even more than they do now.
But like everything connected to redistricting, especially this year, what's okay and what's not is really up to the courts. And a least changes map is at the heart of the redistricting case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
The case was brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, a conservative law firm that files high-profile lawsuits with the state Supreme Court on a regular basis.
The argument in WILL's redistricting lawsuit goes like this. It's the legislature's job to redistrict. But when there's split government, like there is this year, that's probably not going to happen.
And so, without a new map signed into law, Will argues the next best alternative is the old map, because it passed the legislature, was signed by a governor, and already survived lawsuits.
Democrats, as you might imagine, don't care for this argument. A bunch of Democrats filed briefs, including Bill Whitford and other plaintiffs from Wisconsin's famous redistricting case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. They accused conservatives of asking the Wisconsin Supreme Court to do their dirty work.
They had a couple reasons. For one, they don't accept that least changes or core retention is a valid legal principle for redistricting. Beyond that, they say it's not fair because it could entrench the 2011 GOP gerrymander for another decade.
While the legal battle over redistricting isn't over, on November 30th, the Wisconsin Supreme Court did answer this major question. Is a least changes map okay? And their 4-3 majority opinion said, unequivocally, yes.
Writing for the majority, conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley more or less adopted Will's argument. Maps are political decisions, she said, and those are for the legislature to make, not the court.
The court also said it would not look at the partisan makeup of districts. That meant justices would not try to draw a map that's more balanced. Bradley said that would be decidedly non-judicial.
And the court kept going. Conservative justices said they would not decide any partisan gerrymandering cases, like the original Whitford case, the one brought by the Watts Tea Room Group. Remember, the U.S. Supreme Court closed the door to these cases in federal court. Now the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that partisan gerrymandering cases aren't allowed in state court either.
And Justice Brian Hagedorn, the court's swing vote, who everyone was watching, he mostly joined the majority opinion. Hagedorn said legislatures are allowed to draw partisan maps, and it's not the court's place to make political judgments.
The case isn't over. The court still gets a chance to approve specific maps eventually, and a federal court could still weigh in. But this ruling was, without a doubt, a huge win for Republicans, because the map they got to draw after they won big in the 2010 election, that helped them cement their majorities for a decade, could live on until at least 2032.
2032. Between now and then, lawmakers will come and go. The political pendulum will swing. But maybe not in the legislature.
Mapped Out is reported by Bridget Bowden
and Sean Johnson. We're produced by Brad Kohlberg, edited by Noah Ovshinsky. Music by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich.
Digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. Artwork by John Nichols.
You can see more at wpr.org/mappedout.
And that was episode 7 of WPR Reports, Mapped Out, a documentary series about redistricting in Wisconsin. Of course, we will continue to cover redistricting in our conversations on the Ideas Network and in WPR newscasts, bringing you the latest as it unfolds. And you can learn more about the series, hear all the episodes at wpr.org/mappedout. Ahead this hour, we hear a story from Wisconsin Life about the origins of the Culver's franchise, you know, those famous butter burgers made to order. And then we move to one of the nation's leading authorities on the legal history of abortion in America. We talk with Professor Mary Ziegler from Florida State University. Mary Ziegler told NPR last week that she thought she knew how the justices would navigate their arguments, but they did something else.
So, Democrats call the GOP redistricting plan gerrylandering. Republicans have another way to describe
it. I thought the court was going to overrule Roe, but to do so over a course of a couple of steps and a couple of years. And I thought that doing that might be a way for the conservative justices to reach the outcome that they think is correct and that their political allies would celebrate, while managing potential political fallout.
How do you feel about the U.S. Supreme Court's deliberations on abortion? Do you anticipate how the justices would interact on this politically charged issue? What questions do you have about the justices' views or past rulings? 800-642-1234. You can join in. Email ideas at WPR.org. News is coming up next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about the history of the Culver's fast food franchise.
We recently received a question to the Wisconsin Project wondering about the origins of the Culver's franchise. While the popular fast food chain feels almost synonymous with Wisconsin now, that wasn't always the case. WPR's Alyssa Alamand recently sat down with Craig Culver to learn more about the Culver story.
I love this place. Why would you want to live anywhere else? By the way, folks, I'm looking out over the Wisconsin River, the bluffs across the way.
Just about everyone in Wisconsin is familiar with Culver's, whether it's the cheese curds, the custard, or the butter burgers that draw you in. Its popularity has extended beyond its home state to the greater Midwest and even southern states like Texas and Florida. But have you ever wondered how the food chain came to be?
Sauk Prairie is home to me, home to the Culver family, home to Culver's as well.
Sauk Prairie includes the towns of Prairie du Sac and Sauk City, with a population of about 8,000 people total. The two towns collide on Water Street, just down the road from the current Culver's company office, which was built in Prairie du Sac in 2009. 25 years earlier, the first Culver's restaurant opened in Sauk City.
You know, Culver's restaurant wasn't the first business that we've had here. The first business was an A&W drive-in that my parents had that they started in 1961.
The Culver family sold the A&W and moved on to owning two other restaurants in the area, one of which was a supper club, which is where Craig drew inspiration for the Butterburger. The family bought and sold the A&W another time some years later, eventually coming back to the A&W and converting it into what is now the first Culver's location.
That was in 1984, March of 1984, and July 18th, 1984, we opened as Culver's. And as the story goes, we just about didn't make it through that first year.
The restaurant was located right across from a Hardee's, which Craig said was the fastest growing burger chain in the U.S. at that time. And the Dairy Queen Blizzard was invented in 1985. But of course, Culver's made it through. The first successful franchise location is in Baraboo, which opened in 1990. Craig said growth picked up after that, with the company now operating more than 830 restaurants in 25 states. 142 of those locations are in Wisconsin.
That's our mission at Culver's. It's not to see how many restaurants we can have someday. Our mission is how many good restaurants we can have. And it takes great people to make that happen.
Rita Larson was an administrative assistant in accounting for Culver's for 22 years. She retired in October. All three of her sons worked at Culver's throughout high school and college, and her oldest son actually became general manager of the Sauk, Spring Green, and Baraboo restaurants.
It's just always been a family atmosphere where all the team members care about not only what you're going through at work, but even your personal life.
In 2020, the franchise opened a record 50 new locations. Craig says there's a plan in place to open another 300 restaurants down the line, which would put the company at 1,000 locations. Craig will always be proud of his roots.
You know, for me, I grew up here. I love my hometown, and I think that's true with a lot of people. Some people, I guess, want to get away from where they grew up. That was never the case with me. I'm very proud to be from here. I'm very proud to grow the business here that we have.
WPR's Alyssa Alamand brought us that story about the history of Culver's. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to what could be the most substantial challenge to Roe v. Wade in decades. A case brought by Mississippi is attempting to overturn the landmark 1973 ruling. According to the Guttmacher Institute, 26 states, including Wisconsin, are certain or likely to ban abortion if the Supreme Court overturns or guts Roe. So what questions do you have about the oral arguments in the Mississippi case, precedents, justices telegraphing how the court may rule? It's 800-642-1234. Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law and a leading authority on the legal history of abortion in America. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first explain to us what is at stake here in this Mississippi case. Why is Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization at the crux of policy in America?
Well, the case obviously is about a specific law, as all Supreme Court cases are. This one is about a Mississippi law that bans abortion at 15 weeks, which is the point the state says fetal pain is possible. But it's, of course, about much more than that as well. And that's because in order to uphold the Mississippi law, the court either has to say that there's a new line at which states can ban abortion, or say there is no right to abortion at all. And that's because at the moment, the right to choose abortion applies until viability, which is usually around the 24th week. So if Mississippi's law is acceptable, that's either because Roe v. Wade drew the wrong line or because there is no right to choose abortion. And based on the oral arguments, it seems as if the court may be heading towards saying there is no right to choose abortion at all.
And you have been reflecting for years on what the court might do for Roe v. Wade. And we had always talked about how you saw the court chipping away at Roe and not going at it full throttle. Do you feel like there is a sea change here?
I do. I mean, I think that the court sounds ready to undo Wade entirely based on some of the questions that were being asked, based on who's on the court and why they were chosen. I think there's no way coming out of this summer abortion rights in the United States will be the same. And it's quite likely that in places like Wisconsin, there will be no legal abortion or very few legal abortions at all.
Okay, so, and you're saying this summer because you would expect a decision coming out in the June-ish, early July timeframe?
Yeah, correct. So, obviously, you know, we don't ever entirely know the timing of the court's decisions, but absent some kind of, you know, like expedited timeframe, which we don't really expect in this case, we would expect some kind of decision by late spring or early summer of 2022.
So looking at Wisconsin, a 172-year-old law could go back mm-hmm. into effect if Roe is overturned. It would make providing abortions a felony. And if Roe is fully overturned, how could that play out in states like Wisconsin where abortions would become totally illegal under state law?
Well, I mean, one of the other things to emphasize is that in places like Wisconsin, it's not just a function of what's going on in your state. It'd be a function of what's going on in your region. So the 26 states that would likely or certainly ban abortion are concentrated in the South and the Midwest, which would mean that people in Wisconsin who wanted to get legal abortions would, you know, potentially, most likely, in the case of Wisconsin, the closest states would probably be Minnesota and Illinois. Mm. So you would be looking at either travel out of state or trying to get some kind of abortion medication if you're seeking an abortion. Obviously, that might be illegal, right? So we don't know how states would approach actually prosecuting people for performing abortions or seeking abortions, but those are the kinds of questions people in Wisconsin would be having to ask. And of course, travel out of state is, you know, not easy for everyone, depending on the resources they have. And we don't know legally how Wisconsin is going to react to people traveling out of state for procedures that would be considered illegal in state.
And I was reading yesterday, California said it would become a sanctuary state providing abortion rights. And so you really are starting to see states really staking their claim as to what they would do.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, we're likely to see more of that, in part because blue states like California are going to, I think, more often try to make themselves places where people can get legal abortions, potentially even legally funded abortions, which is part of the proposed plan in California. And that's likely to create even more legal showdowns because, of course, states like Wisconsin are probably not going to want, you know, want that to happen or want people to be able to travel out of state. So there'll be battles about whose laws apply, which courts get to decide when states are taking different positions about the legality of a specific act, right? So somebody travels from out of state, who gets to decide whether that's okay?
Mm-hmm. Roe was decided in the year I was born. It was, of course, a different era, close to the passage of the 1960s civil rights laws. This case, it really would make us rethink how political and moral authority interacts between the federal government and the states. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, I think it's also worth emphasizing that, it wouldn't necessarily end in the states, right? This is not a situation where, for example, you know, Wisconsin Right to Life or other groups in Wisconsin that are pro-life or anti-abortion, they're not going to want to stop with states being able to decide. They're likely going to want the Supreme Court to declare abortion unconstitutional everywhere. The reason for that is that, of course, if you're in the right to life movement, you believe that a fetus or unborn person is a rights holding person, and that abortion is unconstitutional, you know, in California too. So we're likely to see the balance between federal and state power rejiggered again, not just a scenario where abortion stays with the states, and that's where we leave things.
What is the ripple effect here? What would happen to birth control or IVF, sexual liberty? What other constitutional rights may be vulnerable?
Well, the most straightforward questions would be about actual birth control. Certain kinds of birth control would probably fall under the heading of abortion, right? So if you remember back to fights about the Obamacare contraceptive mandate, there were lots of what many people consider contraceptives, like IUDs or emergency contraception, that some folks were regarded as abortion-inducing drugs. So the most straightforward outcome would be that some states would treat contraceptives as abortion without, you know, even having a conflict about contraception per se. The other thing I think, I don't think it's as likely we'll see the Supreme Court overrule decisions on contraception per se. I think that's, again, more likely to fall under the heading of abortion. I think more likely we'll see questions raised about LGBTIQ cases, so same-sex marriage, bans on sodomy. We've already seen some conservatives suggesting that those decisions should be revisited. And that's, I think, more likely where we would go rather than decisions on contraception, even though I think contraceptive access will be affected.
Mary Ziegler with us, professor at Florida State University College of Law, written 3 books on abortion history and law. Have you been watching the Mississippi case? What do you think would be the ripple effect on Wisconsin law and state politics? What do you want to ask the historian? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mary Ziegler on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. After hours of public debate last week, the U.S. Supreme Court meets in private to debate whether to uphold Mississippi's ban on abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Supreme Court watchers, they say the decision in the abortion case is not expected until summer, when major rulings tend to arrive. What questions do you have about access to abortion if Roe is overruled? 800-642-1234. We have Florida State Law Professor Mary Ziegler with us, wrote the book on abortion law from Roe to present day with us for about 10 more minutes. Mary, with your historical lens cap on, if you will, looking at the ebb and flow of protections of Roe over the decades, how have you seen protections strengthen or weaken within the last few decades?
Well, obviously, in the past decade or so, we've seen a much more vigorous challenge to abortion rights. And I mean, you would even really say that that's intensified in the years since Donald Trump transformed the Supreme Court, because really, I think up until then, there was a sense in which both pro-choice and pro-life forces were sort of catering to the median voters. So certainly abortion opponents were trying to restrict abortion, supporters of abortion rights were trying to expand access, but everyone was sort of working within limits set by popular attitudes. I think since the Supreme Court has changed, there's a real sense that the anti-abortion or pro-life movement is asking for what it really wants, not necessarily asking for things the public enjoys. So you see, for example, the falling away of things like exceptions for rape and incest, which are quite popular, but not reflective of what the movement wants. Hmm. So in recent years, I think you've seen a fundamental shift in the way the politics work toward, I think, more purist positions, if you will, and probably, in the case of places like Wisconsin, more sweeping bans.
What about the perception of viability and the viability line? Roe said states couldn't ban abortions before fetal viability. You mentioned that earlier about the Mississippi law moving that viability line to 15 weeks. We saw Chief Justice John Roberts suggesting that the court might be able to move the viability line without overruling Roe. So how does that factor into this case?
Yeah, so the Chief Justice was clearly, reaching out for what would sort of pass as some kind of middle ground outcome. I think one thing to emphasize is that overruling the viability line would not be like a small thing, right? So it's not a compromise in the sort of classic sense is something that really wouldn't be a big deal. But I think the Chief Justice didn't want to overrule Roe right away. And how that would work would really depend. But the idea, I think, would be to say, you know, viability has never really made sense as a line because it changes depending on technology, because, you know, whatever one thinks of the value of fetal life, it doesn't really or shouldn't hinge on how dependent it is on somebody else. All of those kinds of arguments, but then the court would leave for another day whether there's a right to choose abortion. That was what I expected the court to do before I heard the oral argument. But during the oral argument, most of the other conservative justices didn't really seem that interested in the Chief Justice's line of questioning, with maybe the exception of Amy Coney Barrett, who did pick up that line of questioning toward the end of the argument. But for the most part, it seemed as if the Chief Justice was sort of alone in trying to forge some sort of middle ground outcome, and the other conservative justices seemed much more interested in revisiting Roe v. Wade as a whole.
What did you hear out of Justice Elena Kagan? There was one line, there's been 50 years of water under the bridge. Where did Elena Kagan fall on this?
Well, Justice Kagan, I think, was quite quiet for her and seemed to be, it's unclear if she was resigned or if she was being strategic, but she did seem to suggest that it was kind of remarkable and also odd that the court was revisiting a precedent like Roe that was so venerable, particularly when there didn't really seem to be an urgent reason to do so. This was not a scenario, for example, where there had been a split in the lower courts as to what to do, and the Supreme Court really had to intervene to shed clarity on the situation. This was a situation where the Supreme Court had sort of picked this up on its own initiative, and I think you saw Justice Kagan kind of questioning why exactly that was.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor expressed this viewpoint during last Wednesday's hearing.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
What did you make of those words?
Well, I think Justice Sotomayor, like most of actually her liberal colleagues, was not focused on the best, you know, constitutional arguments for an abortion right existing. I don't think that's because Justice Sotomayor doesn't think there is such an argument. I think she was speaking to her target audience, which is conservative justices she thinks probably don't agree with her on that point. But I think she was emphasizing not only that Roe was a precedent, but of course that we would be seeing the court entirely undo a precedent that's highly politicized simply because the court's membership had changed. And her concern, I think, was that the court's popularity has already gone down. Perceptions that the court is partisan have already gone up. And if the court delivers an outcome, of course, that Donald Trump promised on the campaign trail, he promised that his justices would reverse Roe as soon as they got the chance, is the court going to be able to convince the American public that it's not a partisan institution anymore? I think that's her concern.
We're talking with Mary Ziegler, who is a professor at Florida State University. Most recent book is called Abortion and the Law in America. You can join in with your thoughts on those oral arguments last week, 800-642-1234. Mary, as you look at public perception and the Pew Research Center saying 6 in 10 Americans believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases, how much does public opinion align with what the court is debating?
Well, I mean, the court doesn't seem concerned about popular opinion, and usually that's fairly unusual. I mean, historians would tell you that most of the time, the court's decisions don't stray too far from what majority opinion would dictate. But if the court does overrule Roe, especially overrule Roe in one fell swoop with no kind of buildup or explanation, I think that would be a departure from popular opinion, especially because what the court would be ushering in is not, you know, bans at 15 weeks. It would be laws like Wisconsin's pre-Roe law, which ban many, many, many more abortions than that, if not all abortions. So this is an instance, I think, in which we may be seeing this current Supreme Court essentially signaling that it's not concerned about public reaction to its decisions. And of course, that could tell you that the court may not stop with something like overruling abortion if that kind of consideration doesn't come into play. Other dramatic rulings could be in store.
Mississippi, not the only one in the last few moments. Texas as well. How likely are other states to follow suit here? Texas law banning abortion once cardiac activity detected in the embryo.
Very likely. I mean, I think the 26 states that we mentioned, I don't think that's where we're going to stop. I think that's the starting point. I think we're quite likely to see more states than that ban abortions. So, I, and as I mentioned, I don't think it necessarily will stop with what we conventionally think of as abortions. So, you know, this is going to be a very different era, I think, when it comes to abortion and other reproductive services in America.
Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University. Latest book called Abortion and the Law in America. Just ahead, we talk about indigenous rights and intimate partner violence. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.